All right, James, it was 11:37 on a Thursday afternoon in March. How are you?
I'm excellent. How are you doing?
Good. The season's almost over. Are you sad? Are you excited for the playoffs? Are you loving all these March games?
By the time you're us and you get to this point, we've watched, like, I watch all the preseason games. I watched the game last night against Buffalo twice. Like, I have a sickness. So, but like, by the time you get to here, it's like, okay, like, let's, it's time for the playoffs. It's time for, like, I feel like we've beaten the storylines to death quite a bit. I feel like sometimes I'm writing an article. I wrote that one article about some of the problems, some of the troubling questions about the Leafs on Monday. And I had to go back on Sunday and read some of the stuff I had written earlier in the season. Just to, I was like, I don't want to like just like say the same thing again. So I went back and looked at, and when there's a season like this where something unexpected happens, which is, we'll see what happens over the last eight games. But like, if they finished the year on a big losing skid, that was really unexpected. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to go back and look at what we wrote during the year and like, were we wrong? Did we miss something? And but I think that there was like a degree of skepticism in a lot of the stuff that we wrote during the season. So anyway, it's a long year. I think there are way too many games in the NHL. I say this all the time. I think it should be a 70 game season, and we're ready for the playoffs. I just hope we're not staying in that crappy Airbnb again in Boston.
Amazingly, the hotel prices in Boston at this time of year are always insane. Because
you know what it is?
It's the marathon, and a lot of the universities have their graduation right around then. But anyway, people don't care about that. So you bring up something that I did want to talk about, and I should mention the podcast is brought to you by The Athletic. So go to theathletic.com/leafreport for 40% off. So this is like something I've been wrestling with like the last couple weeks. How big a deal is this that they're playing this way? Because what sometimes I've realized over the years is that we can make too big of a deal of like five games or six games, even 10 games, because teams throughout the year generally, and Tampa's like the exception this year, everybody kind of goes through these spells where for four, five, six, seven games, they don't look right. Why I think it's probably different is because this has been going on a while, not to this degree. Obviously, the goaltending's been better. How concerning, like, do you think this recent spell is? And this obviously comes, we're talking after they played really well against Nashville and they played really well against Buffalo. So, like, how concerned do you think this recent patch particularly is?
I think the concern is, like you said, that it's been going on for a long time. They've been playing at an 89-point pace, including the win over Buffalo, since the end of December, since December 29th. That's a long period of time to be pretty mediocre. Like, an 89-point pace wouldn't make the playoffs. And a lot of their fundamental underlying stats are down over that time period. So I would say a little bit concerned. I think if they have a really strong... The game against Buffalo, they were great. It was one of their best games of the season. That was their best game in Corsi 4 percentage, Fenwick 4 percentage. It was right up there in the other ones at even strength, score adjusted, even though they had that lull in the third period when Buffalo started to come back. And now it's the Sabres. They're not a very good team, but you want to bury the bad teams at this point of the year, especially when you still have a chance of catching Boston. So I've got a little bit of concern because their record was really built on really high PDO and really high shooting percentage early in the year and a really high power play percentage. And they just haven't impressed me over, I would say, probably a 3-month stretch. So the question of this Leaf season is, can they beat Boston in the first round? The question isn't that. That's the only question that matters. I was saying this on the radio with Matt Cause the other day, is people will remember the season based on what happens in the first round with Boston, and to a lesser extent, what happens against Tampa in the second round. I think if they go to the second round and they push Tampa and it's a 6-game series and it's close, I think the fan base and management and I think everyone can live with this season and that it was in service to something and it went somewhere. If they lose in 5 or 6 games to the Bruins, there's going to be a lot of angst in Toronto.
Well, so that's part of like what I was wrestling with is they could have a really shitty finish to the season, right? And they could still go out in the first round and beat Boston. And then we like that's why I'm like careful like to not over evaluate this stuff. Well, the only thing I would say before you say anything is some of these issues I don't see them changing. So like there is uncertainty with Jake Gardner, there is uncertainty to some degree with Travis Dermott. the top pair is not changing. Ron Hainsey and Morgan Riley are going to be the top pair. Frederik Andersen, I imagine, will bounce back. I don't think he's going to be this moving forward, but he's also had two questionable playoffs. The Boston one worse, obviously, than Washington. Those are the reasons why, like, it's a little more, I could see some reason to be concerned.
You're going to predict that history repeats itself if you're doing the same thing, and the Leafs are largely doing the same thing that they did last year entering the playoffs. They were playing just kind of okay. They were mailing in a lot of games. They had Hainsey on the top pair. They weren't an outstanding possession team. And Boston's been really, really hot. I mean, I know they had that, I think they had a 3-game losing skid or something, but like in general, their second half has been very, very impressive. So, you know, like if we're making predictions today, I don't think I'm picking the Leafs right now. Like I'm not super confident, but they've got another 8 games to show us what they can do. The positive signs, I think, are worth talking about. Auston Matthews looks fantastic. I mean, if he can take this, Nylander's looking really good. What else? I mean, like, Tavares in that line and Marner looks really, really dangerous. I still think this is a better team than last year, even though they're going to finish with fewer points than they had last season. Some of that comes down to just not playing in a shootout all year and stuff like that. But I think these last 8 games are really important for the Leafs to show what they are and to put kind of things together and go into the playoffs on not a down note.
Well, if they get this Auston Matthews in the playoffs, they are a different beast, because like you just think of like the matchup problems that causes, because that Marner line has been generally consistent. Like of late, they haven't looked as good, but if you get Matthews and Nylander going and you've got Tavares and Marner going, and then like you've got a threat of Kasperi Kapanen on the third line, like suddenly you look at that team and you're like, man, that's interesting. And then you've got like Tyler Ennis and Trevor Moore on the fourth line and whoever else is centering, like suddenly they start to look different than they did last year. The one thing like I'm a little wary of when looking at last year's playoffs is there were so many, I don't know if extenuating circumstances, that made it not replicable to this year. Do you know what I mean? Like there were so many things that happened that it's hard to pick that series apart and say that is comparable to what we can expect this year. And some of that is Kadri getting suspended, Matthews scoring once, Thomas Plekanec playing 17 minutes a game, Dominic Moore playing half the series. Both those guys are out of the league. Like there's just stuff that makes me look at that series and say, I don't know if we can totally compare it coming.
I've looked like really closely at the roster last year compared to this one and the different production and things like that. A full 1/3 of the minutes played at even strength were by players that are gone. Mm-hmm. Like it's not like they just lost JVR and Bozak. Yeah. The D's changed a lot. Borgman and Polak played a lot last year. There's been a lot of changes, not that high in the lineup in terms of. And I mean, Johnsson only played 9 games in regular season last year. He was good in the playoffs last year, but you know I think that he can be at another level in this series. Yeah. And I think the thing we can't discount is that all these young guys are another year further in their development. Yeah. So.
Well, and John Tavares is like a massive difference. Huge. Like I'm going to eventually write, or one of us
Bozak
will write.
Had a tough series last year against Boston.
Yeah.
And the Leafs were overmatched down the middle last year, and that's not going to happen this year.
He's a massive X factor, because like suddenly if you're at home, you can match him up against Bergeron and feel really, really confident about that. The one thing that is different, like you mentioned, sorry, there's some sirens going on, city.
Who did you murder?
The defense right now is a really big question mark. Hang on.
You didn't answer the who did you murder question.
Okay, they're gone. The defense right now would be concerning to me, because what's interesting actually is the Hainsey-Riley pair I looked for the last little bit has actually been fine. That doesn't give me confidence if I'm the Leafs going into the playoffs, that it's going to be fine. What would concern me is those other two pairs. Now, if you get Travis Dermott back, which you can assume, that helps. He also is coming back from a month off, which isn't easy.
He's coming back from the same thing Matthews came back. And you remember how long it took Matthews to look normal? Like, that would be
like a month.
That would be my concern with Dermot, is that... Mm-hmm. And Dermot's a pretty physical player. And
well, and so what also would concern me there is, I think the ideal thing to do, if I was Mike Babcock, would be to go to that Muzzin-Dermot pair, and use that as my second pair. But I don't think that's what's going to happen. I think he's going to keep Muzzin with Zaitsev, and I think he'll put Dermot with whoever, Hozhiganov or whatever. And that, to me, doesn't feel like it's... That would worry me, because Muzzin's not as good as Gardner, so that Muzzin-Zaitsev pair is not as good. And I just can't see him relying on Dermot and whoever on that third pair a whole bunch. Like, so that kind of gives me some angst.
The whole Gardner thing is really important. I've been working on getting an update on where he's at. I wrote a piece earlier in the week that was kind of a bit doom and gloom. It's the same thing with Dermot. I mean, if you miss that much time and you have that serious of an injury and it's your back, there's going to be uncertainty about that, even if he does come back. And he's going to be coming off a long layoff, and how much can you rely on him in key minutes? But it really changes the complexion of their decor when they don't have those two guys.
Yeah.
I mean, the Buffalo game, Ozhiganov played 8.5 minutes and Hall played 7.5. I can't remember the last game I've seen the Leafs play where the third pair played that little.
Yeah.
Maybe ever. Like, I can't ever remember a third pair playing under 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Brett Lebda used to get like 8 or 9 minutes some games, but they would always play the fifth guy more. To have the two guys not play, and then everybody else was between 23.5 and 25.5. Mm-hmm. Second game of a back-to-back. Like, that's really wild. That's the opposite of load management. I said to you on Slack, the channel that we talk on last night, it's load mismanagement.
We can talk about that. We will definitely talk about that. But that is, I think we should spend a couple minutes here on Gardner. Lots of things you mentioned there are interesting. The one thing, like, as far as the layoff is concerned, you could get him back and the same thing could pop up again. Like, that's what is a little scary for him and for the Leafs, is like, he had the break, obviously, in the All-Star break. They didn't play him the final two games before the break, hoping that it would help. He played a bunch of games, and then it popped up again. Like, that's really scary. And, like, you think of all the little things that he does. I don't know, like, you just can't replace that. Jake Muzzin is not him. Jake Muzzin can't move the puck like he can. He can't skate the puck like he can. And so suddenly you look at their three pairs. They go from having, like, three guys, one on each pair, who can skate the puck out and who can make all these little clever passes, good breakout passes to get out of the zone. And now suddenly you've got one. And on the other two pairs, you don't really have that commodity, and to me that really hurts them.
Think about it this way. How do you think the Bruins players are going to approach playing Jake Gardner when he's playing through severe back pain that's kept him out half the season?
Hammer him.
They are going to. Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're going to get David Backes, all 235 pounds of him on the fourth line, and Corrali. And one of the things that impressed me with the Bruins early in that series is that they were just super, super aggressive on the Leafs' defense. Mm-hmm. They were all over them. They were up the Leafs' ass, like, especially those first two games of that series, and the Leafs didn't have an answer for it. And I don't know what you do. I mean, Gardner's not the easiest guy to hit, but he also always tries to make the play, and I could see that potentially leaving him. He's got the puck so much. Yeah. I could see it leaving him vulnerable if the Bruins just try and hammer him over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Well, and he just, if you look at the numbers, and like, I've wanted to use these numbers and just never found a place, and you've kind of referenced them a bit, but like, you look at the difference between Muzzin Zaitsev as a pair and Gardner Zaitsev as a pair. Gardner props up Zaitsev so much more, and you can just see it in like all the little things that he can do, where Zaitsev will move the puck to him, and like, he's just elusive, and he can get himself out of trouble, and he can make these short little passes. Well, and Jake Muzzin just he can't do that. That's not who he is.
What's happening with the Muzzin-Zaitsev pair is that Muzzin's being asked to move the puck over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And that's, like, he's not bad at that, but he shouldn't be. Like, when it really worked for LA, Muzzin was playing with Doughty, and Doughty was doing a lot of the puck moving. And, mm-hmm. like, I like Muzzin. I think he's starting to get to where they need him to get. And I think he's going to be a better player. He hasn't been that consistent, has been his problem. He's had good games and he's had poor games. But it's a lot to ask him to carry his D partner as much as he's being asked to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and that's why, you know, you get Dermott back and like it slightly changes the foundation of what you're doing. Again, like we'll see what kind of player Dermott is.
The thing that I liked about Dermott early in the year, even though he probably didn't play as much as we would have liked to see him play, he gave them a very good third pair, which they don't have right now. And you can't underrate that, because if you look at even strength minutes, typically, not against Buffalo, but typically, the third pair plays a lot. Like, they play a pretty high percentage of the even strength minutes. It matters. Like, having Dermott on that third pair and propping up, it was Ojaganov most of the year, having that gave them one of the best, at least one defenseman on a third pair in the league.
Well, the way to look at it is they were winning those shifts, and now they're not winning those shifts.
Yeah, and now they don't even have those shifts.
Yes. Wow, and that's another separate issue.
Oh, I keep skipping ahead.
We can talk about it now. Actually, let's talk about it now. So I wrote about load management and why I think the Leafs
give them something to talk about.
The Leafs should copy the Raptors and use load management. It is like, boil it down in basic terms, it really seems like common sense not to do this stuff or to do this stuff. Like, it doesn't make sense to play Ron Hainsey 24 minutes in both games on a back-to-back. It doesn't make sense to be playing 39-year-old Patrick Marleau every single game
getting a lot of minutes, too.
Played 17 minutes. They played Trevor Moore 5 minutes and 41 seconds in Buffalo. That doesn't make sense. Like, you're trying to win a cup. You shouldn't be... You got to think bigger than this. And I'm sure if you got Kyle Dubas and you could give him truth serum and, like, he told you exactly what he wanted to do, I'm sure this would be part of it. But, like, man, it feels like it's long past time that the NHL started doing this stuff. They're so far behind the other sports. Like, baseball, they've had innings limits and pitch counts and all that stuff for years. The Spurs were resting players 7, 8, 9 years ago, giving guys minutes restrictions. I think it's crazy that this hasn't happened in the NHL, and I think the Leafs should really, really consider in these last couple weeks resting some of their players.
Kyle, if you're listening and you agree with us, tweet out a cryptic gif in the next few days, and then everyone will know what it was about. Retweet some other GM from other sport with a cryptic check mark, and then everyone will know. I was just looking up as you were talking. I was looking up the percentage chance of the Leafs passing the Bruins to get home ice, because that's ostensibly what they potentially could be playing for right now. What percentage chance do you think they have of getting past Boston and getting home ice?
Like 12%, something like that.
That is exactly what the number is.
Seriously, well, wow!
I'm looking at sports stats, which I'm not supposed to, but that's exactly what it says is 12. I think, yeah. 12%. I don't know.
And the thing is, like, the one thing, like, I've been thinking about that is how much, like, value is that one extra home game? Does it matter? Sure. You're also starting the series at home. Like, there is some importance to that. But is it worth, like, burning out all your players just to get that? No, I don't think so. And you can still win games, like, if you sat Ron Hainsey or sat Patrick Marleau or sat Frederik Andersen.
I think one of the tough things for the Leafs is that the Marlies have had a bunch of injuries on D. Like, I think we would have seen Rosen would have been playing a lot of these games. Borgman, even, I could see them calling him up right now with... Marincin's got that flu that everybody's got, I guess.
Yeah.
The death plague. Oh, the sirens are back again. Jonas, what did you do? Maybe they didn't like my parking job. I parked on Spadina. I was, like, the only car there. I hope it was legal. Your entire neighborhood is under construction.
It's the city, man. Welcome to Toronto.
I'm going back out to my quiet East End neighborhood.
But why do you think this hasn't happened in the NHL yet?
Oh, there's a lot of things that haven't happened in the NHL yet. Like, they haven't seen the evidence for it is one thing. Mm-hmm. Like, but you know what's funny, though? Like, there's a lot of more progressive teams and GMs than there has ever been in the NHL, and they're still not to the level of... I think the NBA, the analysis is so fine-tuned that they can see the impact that is having. And they can quantify it. And when you can quantify it, we're seeing it to some extent with the goalies, where, like, the Leafs can quantify that they want to play their backup on the second night of a back-to-back? Because I don't know the numbers on that, but they've obviously ran the numbers on that and figured out that you should play your starter on the first game because it gives you X percentage chance to win when he's rested. And then you play your backup on the second game and you just kind of take your chances that you're going to win some of those games like they did against Buffalo.
Well, and they would bring that to Mike Babcock and he'd be like, okay, that makes sense.
Well, I bet you the analysis was convincing.
Well, and so what I don't understand, and I was asking you this question on Slack, is don't you think it'd be pretty easy for Kyle Dubas to go to his R&D team and be like, okay, I want you to find out what it looks like when Ron Hainsey plays in the second half of a back-to-back versus what he plays like at one day rest, 2 days rest, all that kind of stuff. And then I can go to Babcock and I can say, look at this. This is simple.
Not only that, but like they have a really high-end strength and training team, and they use the world's top technology. They use the catapult system where the players are wearing a harness. Mm-hmm. Or now they've got it in their shoulder pads. They wear like a little... it's got a gyroscope in it and it's got a computer chip in it and it kind of measures all of the different loads on their body and all of these things. I mean, that's what the other sports are doing. I remember going to Sloan and they were talking about it, about the NFL and NBA and even baseball, that they look at all of those things and then they use, like, they don't just have to look at the results in games. They can look in the practice and be like, oh man, like, we killed Ron Hainsey and like he's only skating at 2 miles per hour today when he should be at 2.8. And we need to manage his load.
Well, it feels like even if you don't have that data, like, just simple common sense would say to you, like, let's be really sure. Like, we have this 39-year-old Patrick Marleau. Why, like, we've got this game Monday against Florida. Why are we playing him? Like, what benefit? We're trying to, like, we need him to be able to go 2.5 months after the season. After the regular season, what are we doing here? Like, why are we burning him out? Let's just play for one night. Let's play Trevor Moore 17 minutes and we'll sit Marleau. For one night, let's sit Ron Hainsey and let's use Travis German on the top pair. Like, let's try these things and test these different guys in different situations. You're not even necessarily going to lose. Like, it's a different league, but the Raptors sit Kawhi Leonard all the time and can still win because they have a good team. The Leafs have a good team. Even if they sat John Tavares one night just to rest him, they could still win that game. Like, and even if they didn't win that game, like, you're trying to, like, think bigger than what coaches sometimes want to do. And I think that's, I don't know, I feel like that's the bridge that they have to cross in the NHL.
The Leafs have made some progress in that respect, and that, like, there are some things that Babcock has bought in with. I mean, they've taken over the injury recovery and things like that, because Babcock was pushing guys to come back too early. Early in his tenure with the Leafs. I mean, that was, and there were guys playing through things that they shouldn't have been. I remember Dan Winnick, like, limping around on the ice when he had the injury that I think it was an ankle sprain or something like that he had to play through. But it hasn't gone all the whole way. But then we don't know what the sports science team and what the GM and management are saying to Babcock about resting guys. We don't know, because they haven't told us. And Babcock's been asked about this. I remember him being asked about it at the end of last year when they were playing a lot of meaningless games. And his response was something along the lines of, you also want to keep guys ready.
Yeah, and that's valid. But do you really think if you sat Patrick Marleau in Buffalo that that's going to impact how he's going to be ready for game one?
Marlo's complicated because of the Iron Man streak.
Okay, so
I'm glad you could put a GIF on the podcast, because I have a GIF of someone in an Iron Man costume ironing.
Okay.
That's what I sent you when you asked me why they won't sit Marleau.
I'm glad you brought this up. What is most important? Yes, the GIF is, like, the good news is you haven't made any puns yet so far in the podcast.
I saw that GIF of Iron Man ironing and I just, like, that made my day. So I had to send it to you. And then I sent it to someone else too.
Okay, well, so all due respect, what Patrick Marleau has accomplished is incredible. So what? What are you trying to do here? Are you trying to win a cup? Or are you trying to, like, make sure that this streak is intact?
Do the Leafs get a trophy if he sets the all-time Ironman record?
No, you get shit. And it's awesome, and, like, it's impressive, and it's the sixth longest streak in history. So what? Like, these streaks are going to come to an end at some point anyway. If you really want to win a cup and you're trying to do everything you possibly can, even if it gives you, a little tiny percentage chance, improved chance, by him being a little bit more rested, fresh, whatever, Why not? Like, I just don't. To me, that's not good enough. Anyway, they can do whatever they want. I just don't think it's smart.
Did you say they literally get shit?
Yeah, they don't get anything. What do they get?
I don't think they literally get. Did you see? There's that poll on Twitter. Someone's ranking. Who's the worst media member? Hockey media member? Did you see it?
I saw you're a number one seed.
I'm a number one seed.
Amazing! Congratulations.
Why would that? And they also put me against Down Goes Brown. They put me against like the most popular media person possible.
So you're going out in the first round.
Well, I was surprised I got 20% of the.
Well, so wait, are you supposed to vote for the one you don't like?
Yeah. I'm getting like 79% of the vote against Dan Goes Brown. I thought it would be like, I mean, Dan Goes Brown. I would vote for me over Dan Goes Brown. He's my favorite media member too. But what you win, the trophy is in a picture at the top. Have you seen it?
Yes.
It's the golden turd.
Yes.
I kind of want to win that.
Do you think you have a chance? Like, who do you think your toughest competition is?
Oh boy, there's a lot of. I don't want to say who I think the worst media member is. I'm sure there are a lot of media members hated a lot more than me. This year has been really interesting because I find that the longer the Leafs are a good team, like they're a top five team, and the more we're writing positive stories about them and tweeting positive things about them, the more backlash I get. Like my Twitter feed is, I know you don't read a lot of what you're, like the stuff I get is like, holy cow, like just crazy. People are saying like, I get like really misogynistic stuff. I get stuff making fun of what I look like. I get like all kinds of stuff. I've had people say stuff about my kids and stuff. Like, it's just crazy.
Don't read it. But anyway, but you know what is interesting about that? The whole media fan thing? I wouldn't know about
the Golden Turd trophy.
Well, I do think it's interesting that you can't sell fans garbage anymore. They're too smart. Like, so when you, so what I think is happening a lot now is the old analysis is still being spit out, and fans are too smart for that. Like, it doesn't work. But anyways, some fans. Okay.
I mean, we're trying to do smart analysis, and then like there's people attacking you.
Yeah, but that's the world. People criticize everything. People criticize sunshine, I think.
That's why I kind of, that quote that Babcock had during the Tavares thing about all that matters is the people whose knees touch your kitchen table or whatever. I mean, there's some truth to that.
For sure. A lot of those things he says, like, are true. It's not easy to, like, live those things all the time, but they're true. Good segue. I do think we should talk about
Siegel Way,
Babcock and Kyle Dubas, because that's kind of become, like, a little bit of a thing.
What do you think the gift meant that Kyle put a checkmark on from Daryl Morey, the GM of the Houston Rockets, and also the founder of the Sloan Statistics Conference?
Well, I think you could read it any way you want. The way he thinks to me, like, about sports is basically what that tweet was, like, that just because something is obvious and like has been done a certain way doesn't mean it's right, and that sometimes more complex things.
But it wasn't like a direct, it didn't feel like,
No, it just felt like an endorsement of a way of thinking that he believes.
You can't read that as a direct response to what Babcock said, because no. Babcock said, we need to get better and have more depth.
Which is true. And
simple wrong thinking. Like, I'm sure Dubas wants them to have more depth too.
Yes. Fair. It's just the timing of it looked weird.
Yeah.
Well,
we know that Dubas knows what Babcock said.
Yes. Now, do you think that was a shot at... I don't think that was a shot at Dubas.
Well,
I think to me what he was saying is there's all these other organizations who for a long time have been developing players and developing good players. So they're better set up to handle stuff than the Leafs, who've only like really been like in this kind of state for a few years. They haven't built up as much of an infrastructure because they just haven't been doing it as long. Or do you think he was like...
You know what the problem with that is? The problem with that is, so the Leafs are missing two of their, I would say, best four or five NHL D. They're missing three, probably their best Marlies D.
Yep.
The thing is that, like Boston has had a whole bunch of injuries this year, and they kept winning games.
Yep.
And it's not because you look at Providence and that team is loaded with a whole bunch of great players. Mm-hmm. That's not what it's about. It's about building a system where you can plug and play other pieces and use them efficiently and continue to play the same way and continue to win. And that's what Boston is great at. The Leafs are not good at that. That's not just about the quality of your players. I don't know exactly what their record is, but the Marlies probably have a better record than Providence. Like it's not like the Marlies are one of the worst teams in the AHL. They're fine. Like there are players there they can use. are they being used properly, or are they being recalled and played 5 minutes a game?
Well, to be honest, like, a lot of the Marlies haven't really been called up this year. Like, there haven't been a lot of guys who've come up and played. Trevor Moore is one. Who else? Like, there's not really a ton who've actually come up and played. We didn't see Carl Grundstrom before he got traded. We haven't seen Jeremy Bracco.
You know, Callie Rosen. Saying,
no, you're right. But we, like, they
Marlies have a better record than Providence. Like, it's a better team. I mean, part of that might be that Boston's had to use a bunch of those guys, but
I just don't think it's been a thing this year. Like, the guys that they're using weren't Marlies. And like you said, Callie Rosen was injured. Like, so instead of playing Martin Marincin, you'd be playing Rosen.
But this idea that the Leafs' depth is shittier, it doesn't make any sense. Like, we've been talking all year about how good their depth is.
Well, I never thought that was... I never totally bought into that. Like, they don't have... They're thin at center beyond the NHL. You look at, like, even their wingers, like, there's not a ton there that you could, like, if you had a rash of injuries that you'd be really confident about plugging in.
But let's be honest, though, Babcock's talking about defense.
Well, and so this is where it's unfair, and it's a little bit of, like, it's kind of bullshit to say it. You've had these guys on your team who you've chosen not to play, and you may not like Justin Hall. That's totally fine. But you can't then be upset that when you need Justin Hall, he hasn't played, like, and he's not ready to play.
The other thing, too, is that Babcock talks a big game about being involved in the recruiting of these players and how much he likes them and whatever. And then if you're going to be GM/coach, then you have to wear some of these decisions. Like, if the guys you want on your defense when you're GM/coach are Zaitsev and Ozhiganov and they're not playing well, that's partly on you.
Yeah.
You can't just say, oh, the GM didn't get anyone good. Well, it's like, well...
Well, I mean, and then
been involved in this process of acquiring players and building this team.
Yeah. Well, and then, like, when
Look at Par Lindholm. You know, he played the crap out of that guy, and he can't play. He had, like, 1 point in 4 years or something.
Well, and then, like, you get Nick Batan, and, like, you immediately... You do not... enthusiastically rave about what he can do.
No,
you
kind of gave him the Golden Turd Award, and, like, after his first game. Like,
well, and I didn't think that was fair. Like, to come out after that Vancouver game and say, like, I did a disservice to the team basically by dressing that fourth line. Like, that's, man, like, if you want to build these guys up, you're not doing it. And if you get Jake Muzzin and you kind of, like, you say, well, it's not perfect, and that's true, but, like, you're also not really,
you know what?
I don't know.
You're not being a team player. You know what? Babcock's reminded me of a little bit the last whatever. He reminds me of Ron Wilson a little bit. Like, he just can't help himself from saying the negative thing. Like, when it's a detriment to his team, and it just doesn't seem to be any value in. Like, Patan plays one game, and he's like, "Oh, I did a disservice to our team." Like, you're playing Vancouver in a game that doesn't mean anything, and you just got this young guy who's been benched the whole year in Winnipeg.
Yes,
like, what?
What are you serving? Why? Like, why do that?
What? Yeah. You haven't even seen the guy play.
Yeah.
Like, he wasn't good in that game, but so what? Like, I don't know. It's funny because, like, the whole thing that the Dubas always talks about and subscribes to is the idea of the process. There's no process involved if you acquire a guy and look at him for 5 minutes and say, hey, I can't play him.
Yeah.
On a fourth line in limited minutes. Like, that's nuts.
Well, and I found it interesting, and, like, this is just a report at this point, but the timing of Nick Batan potentially getting a 2-year extension seemed a little interesting. Now, obviously, it probably has nothing to do with it, because it makes sense to sign Nick Batan for 2 years at this point when his value is really low and he's someone who can play in the NHL and you need as many pieces as you can, and the contract's probably going to be one where you can just bury it if you have to.
Well, it's the same with the Sparks contract too, right?
Yeah.
It's the same thing. Like, I'm sure Babcock looks at Curtis McElhinney's numbers and then looks at Garrett Sparks' numbers and then looks back at McElhinney's numbers. And I'm sure he feels like, look, I was right.
And he might not be wrong. Like, the process, though, if you're going by this process idea, the right process was always taking Sparks. It's really hard to watch Sparks right now and be confident in him if you're the Leafs. But, like, you still have to make decisions in a process, and that means, like, trying to make the right decision at the time and not looking back and saying you should have done this. You know what I mean? Like, does that make sense?
Right. And the thing with goalies too is, I mean, like, we're looking at such a narrow sliver of, I mean, Curtis McElhinney could come out next year and his number, he's pretty close. I think he's at a .915 save percentage. He allowed 8 goals last week. not to take anything away from Curtis Magalini, who's been a great story, and it's just, I don't know. I think it's a bit early to definitively say that. And the other thing, too, is I was looking at how much that's actually hurt the Leafs. It hasn't been that significant. Like, if the backup goalie had a 9.15 save percentage right now as opposed to a 9.03...
Yeah, it's like a few goals.
It's I think it's like 7 or something. It's not that big of an impact on what's happened in the Leafs season. That's not the defining reason that the Leafs are going to have a weaker record mm-hmm. than last year.
Well, and so I think to close this, I think if you're Babcock, you've got to kind of change the way you think about these things. And you have to look bigger. And you have to say, you know what? I have to really try to do everything I possibly can to maximize whatever Justin Hall is. I may not think he's good, but like, he is a piece of our roster. He could be helpful. Let's like try to make sure we build him up. And this is what the, like, to go back to the load management stuff, this is what the San Antonio Spurs do fucking amazingly, is they build up their players and they maximize their potential and they try to look at like what they do well and try to fit them in.
Well,
and so like there are things that Justin Hall does well. He may not be heavy, may not be like that gutsy whatever type like Roman Polak, but there are things he does better than Roman Polak. Focus on that stuff. Focus on Nick Patan's skill, not that he's 5'9 and 179.
It's funny, you know, one of the things that people with the Marlies say that Justin Hall does well is he takes a hit to make a play. Mm-hmm. So it's like the anti-Polak. Like, he's not the guy initiating the contact and doing that. Mm-hmm. But the thing he does, it probably makes him look soft that he's getting beat up all the time. But yeah. I know, at least with watching the Marlies, he would often take that shot and but the puck would go in the right direction or to the right player that they wanted it to. And the thing, what you're talking about, maximize, like, if Babcock wants to be coach GM, he should look at every single player he has on the roster as an asset mm-hmm. and not blackball like four of them. And like, you might not like Nick Batan, but you're right, like, okay, give him really sheltered minutes or put him on the second power play unit. And I mean, he should be trying to build some of these guys up.
Yeah.
Like, there's, if you're Justin Hall or if you're Patan or you're one of these young guys that's barely played in the NHL, like Trevor Moore, or I mean, even Garrett Sparks, how high is your confidence level right now? It might not be great.
No.
Part of the coaching staff's job should be like, you want to give them all of the different pieces. It can't just be like you're in the military or something and it's like,
yeah,
perform or you're gone, and you just do that over and over and over again, because you're going to be cutting long term, you're going to be losing pieces that might potentially be valuable.
Yeah.
Short term, you're not getting as much out of those guys
mm-hmm.
as you could.
Well, imagine,
which,
like,
is the whole point.
Yeah, you're right. Like, imagine if you're Nick Batan, you've just spent like 2 years under Paul Maurice, who clearly has no time for you, doesn't play you, and then you come here. Imagine hearing like what Babcock says about you.
You'd be like, four shifts.
You'd be like, man, like, I'm in the same position again. As opposed to if the coach came out and be like, man, I like that, like, this Nick Patan might have something. Suddenly I'm Nick Patan. I'm like, man, maybe I got a chance. Maybe I'll feel better about myself. Maybe I'll play better. There's just no downside to doing it that way. The difference is, like, Mike Babcock likes to, he doesn't bullshit. But sometimes, like, you can finesse these things where yeah. you don't have to be so blunt.
It's good for us in the media because we know exactly what he's thinking all yeah. of the time. But I think it does a disservice to the organization sometimes. And just, especially with the way the media market is here.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll close there. Get your Bab socks or your Socky Hall of Fame socks. You can subscribe.
I still got to go buy some more Socky Hall of Fame socks.
Yeah. You should get one of the mystery packs.
I know, but I'm a bit worried I'm going to get some sort of mystery I don't want.
Who would you
want? I'll just gift it to you. Well, there's some pretty weird players on there. There's like Adam Graves and stuff like that.
Adam Graves is awesome.
I think.
You didn't like Adam Graves?
I didn't like the Rangers.
Oh, Adam Graves is like everything you want.
I wasn't a huge Canucks fan, but that 94 team, I really had. That was like one of my favorite teams ever, that run they went on. I was 13 years old, and I got on the bandwagon. Round two, they played Dallas, and that was a great series. Bray, like, cheap-shotted and took out Shane Chirla, and, like, and that was just, like, a real lunch pail team that, and the Rangers were, like, the embodiment of what I didn't like as a young person watching, in that they were, like, the high-spending, acquire a bunch of free agents.
Yep.
You got Keenan, who's not super likable. You got Messier, who I didn't find super likable, especially after his turn in Vancouver. I was not a big Rangers fan.
Did you love Bure? Like, I feel like...
No, but he was the most popular player. I liked Kirk McLean. Huh. I really like goalies when
That's
I...
That's interesting.
And I really like Trevor Linden. Huh. And I liked some of the, like, some of the depth guys they had on that team.
Who do you think the closest comparable to Bure is right now in the league? Is it Kucherov? Not really.
No.
Because Bure is like a burner. Like, who is that? I don't know if there is someone.
It's a bit like Ovechkin, but Ovechkin's obviously got like some different elements and stuff. Like, it's someone who like plays in real straight lines. That Bure was amazing. I don't know. I just, when as a hockey fan, I always was like the hipster that hockey fan that I would pick like the stay at home defenseman that was I really liked. Or it was hard to not like Trevor Linden and Kirk McLean though. And Kirk McLean played stand up style, and like he was an exciting goalie to watch.
When did you lose your Canuck fandom?
Well, they immediately went in the shitter like 2 or 3 years later. I eventually decided it doesn't make sense to like cheer for a team that like the roster. I don't know. The roster's always changing. You got incompetent people running it. Anyway, I lost it for good. I think when I moved to Toronto, and I was never that invested in it. Hmm. The Canucks were always my dad's team from the mid '80s until that 94 run. They were pretty bad.
Mm-hmm. And then they got good.
When I was like a 7 or 8 year old kid and it's late 80s and the Oilers are and the Flames are pumping them every night, it's like, why would I cheer for that? Like, why is my dad watching this brutal team get brutalized? So anyway, if I was a Canucks fan, I was a bad one because it didn't last very long.
All right, we'll leave it there. Canucks fan James Myrtle. So we'll be back next week with another edition of the pod. So thank you for listening. Thank you to Andrew Nolan for producing, as always. And go to theathletic.com/leafreport for 40% off. We got tons of content about everything in sports.
Playoffs!
Thanks.